Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the founders, clinicians, CEOs, leaders, investors and this week journalists who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am the CEO and co-founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc has developed a set of technology, including our flagship Healthy Heart Check, which enables you to give yourself the equivalent of the NHS Health Check at home within 10 minutes, wherever you are. If you want to have more information about that, please go to pocdoc.co. That's pocdoc.co. And thank you to PocDoc for supporting the show, as always. Thank you also to the amazing UK Health Radio for the live platform. We love, love, love being on UK Health Radio. There are some amazing presenters on the station. It's not just the Health Tech Hour, some incredible shows, so please check them out. Thank you also if you are listening on demand on your podcast channel of choice. We get downloads now in over 50 countries every month. You could say that we're the expanded World Cup format of Health Tech Hour podcasts if you're following the football. And thank you if you are watching this on our YouTube channel, which is Health Tech Hour, or on our Instagram channel, The Health Tech Hour, or my own Instagram, which is at Steve Roost. So thank you so much for being part of our journey. And thank you to our guest today, Paul Gallagher, who is one of the leading journalists in the healthcare space in the UK, having been or is currently a sort of 20-year veteran of healthcare journalism. That you told me that, so you can't blame me for you can't blame me for outing you on that one, including writing for The Times and The Telegraph and The Mirror. He is also the lead writer on the upcoming annual report for the Alzheimer's Disease Association.
International.
Alzheimer's Disease International, which is focused on clinical trials this year. So there's quite a lot to get into, but Paul, welcome to the show. Sorry for messing up that bit about the Alzheimer's.
No problem at all.
We don't edit anything in the show, so that will go out. So that's good to know. But apologies, good to get corrected. So there's a lot to get into.
Absolutely.
You've been in this healthcare, you've been talking, writing, thinking about healthcare in the UK and beyond, because I know that you've got connections into Japan, having spent time there. Where do you think we are in 2026 versus where potentially 20 years ago you thought we might be?
Oh, that's a good question to kick off things off with. I mean, I covered healthcare. I was a health correspondent for the iPaper for 10 years. So I saw a lot of changes within the NHS, obviously the impact of the the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Which has set things back a long way compared to where we were when I first started out covering health. There has been huge issues within the NHS in particular for a long time. I think fundamentally one of the main problems in the UK is that for people in the UK, they generally want to pay US levels of taxation but expect Scandinavian levels of public services back. And that's been a fundamental issue for quite a while. There's a disconnect there in terms of people, what they pay into public services and what they expect to get back out. I mean, when we went into the pandemic, the NHS waiting list, which I've covered many, many times over the last
years. How many articles do you reckon you've written on that?
A couple of hundred at least.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, going into the pandemic, the waiting list was already at 4.4 million.
For routine surgery.
That's just in England.
Right.
And then obviously the pandemic came along and it skyrocketed up to well over 7 million, almost touching 8 million procedures that people were waiting for. And some people waiting for more than one procedure. So it relates to about 7 million patients. It's come down slightly, but that is at the heart of what we're seeing across the NHS, the backlogs.
Mm.
if there's a problem in one area within the NHS, and not just the NHS, within social care, because everything is so interconnected, it has a knock-on effect everywhere else. So I'm sure you're well aware of all the problems that we have in social care as well at the minute.
It just feels like that whole area is so complicated and has been orphaned.
Yeah, and it's separate, and it's very much separate to the NHS as well. So it's going to be fascinating to see what Andy Burnham does when he inevitably becomes Prime Minister in 10 days, however many time it is, because he's obviously coming from Greater Manchester, which has had a reasonable amount of success with integrating the NHS and social care. So it's going to be fascinating to watch what he does on the national level, because a lot of people have been calling for a long time that the two do need to be integrated. I mean, at any one point within the NHS, there are something like 1 in 3, 1 in 4 beds are filled with people. A lot of people don't like the phrase bed blockers, people who are medically fit to be discharged, but there's no package in the community because they're generally older people, people with comorbidities, lots of things wrong with them. There's no package available for them because of issues with social care. So essentially you've got 25 to 30, 33% of beds filled with people in hospitals who don't need to be there.
And about these individuals, these patients who are in hospital, they have problems, they have conditions, they have that they're in hospital for good reasons, if that makes sense. What happens? Do they stay there indefinitely, or like what is happening on the ground, like that you've discovered through the course of writing about this?
Yeah,
because 25 to 30% is a statistic, but that's literally millions of people.
Yeah.
So are they there indefinitely? They're there for 3 days, not 4 days. Like, what are we talking about here?
Essentially, just delayed. They're there for longer than they need to be. Obviously, in the past, there've been issues with infections in hospitals, the MRSA, superbug, things like that. So the longer you are in hospital, the more likely it is that you're slightly more open to risk than you would be,
particularly if you're elderly.
Exactly. Absolutely. But of course, before an elderly person can be discharged, they have to be. There are certain things that have to be put in place. So they have to be discharged to somewhere where everybody knows they're going to be safe. If that's their own home, have to be all kinds of risk assessments carried out at the home by a social care workforce team to make sure they don't just send them home, they trip on the rug, break their leg, and then they're back in hospital for 6 months. So assessments need to be made at home,
And those assessments need to talk to the hospital team.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's definitely non-trivial.
No.
It sounds easy, but it isn't.
No, exactly. Everyone's rushed off their feet.
Also, where does that report go? Who does that go to? Like, what?
Well, this is an issue with continuity of care. I mean, one of the problems that I've found over the years is that there's no one person, one medic in charge of that patient's overall healthcare. There are as many as between anything upwards of 10 or 12 medics looking after the one patient, especially if they're elderly, especially if they've got more than one issue. So it's often slow. There are lots of delays within the system, and everything just gets backed up. There's been a staffing issue. I mean, staffing's been one of the main problems that the NHS has had for years. Around 100,000 vacancies across the NHS.
Yeah.
In England, we've slowly cottoned on to the fact that we need to train more staff. For too long, we've relied on hiring staff from overseas, not training enough people here. Mm. And Brexit had an impact with that, with staffing levels as well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing a story for The Independent over 10 years ago now, where I was at my local hospital in Bedford, and there were 44 Spanish nurses starting on the same day.
Wow.
So I went down and did a piece talking to them about why they've come. And that's kind of an issue that never really gets discussed too much within the NHS, because for good reasons, the NHS is praised for its diversity of its workforce. People from, I think the House of Commons Library did a report saying how many countries are actually where you have people coming from to work in the NHS. It's over 100.
Yeah, I would have said over 100.
Have people represented within the NHS. But the ethical issue, which rarely gets spoken about, is when the NHS hires large numbers of staff from much poorer countries, because what does that do to those countries over there who are already struggling? We allow those countries from Africa or South Asia or wherever it may be to spend all that money in hiring their staff, but then we go over and recruit them. I mean, the NHS has gone over and held recruitment fairs in Lisbon, in Spain, in other countries around the world to try and essentially poach staff to come and work here. because if we didn't, we'd have even more problems with vacancies and workforce. But you rarely, that's rarely a topic that's
and
discussed.
What, out of interest, why from a journalistic perspective is that not covered? Is it just not, it's no one will publish it because it's kind of an omerta type concept?
Or yeah, like what? It's possibly seen as more of a controversial issue because perhaps news editors in the past have felt that you open themselves up to accusations of racism.
Yeah, that's going to be complicated.
British staff for British patients. It's an easy, you set yourself up for perhaps a bit of unwanted criticism, so it's therefore easier not to
interesting
talk about that. But it's an issue that's been going on for decades now.
Yeah.
As the population has surged, especially over the last 10, 15 years, as we've become a much more older society, with many more people having comorbidities, we're not the fittest society in the world. I mean, childhood obesity levels are extraordinary. Yep. So generally, a lot more people are needing help within the NHS, and we just don't have the staff numbers available to look after them.
And where does technology come into all of this? Because technology is often thrown around. Yeah. And I say this as a health tech entrepreneur and co-founder, so I'm sort of slightly biased, but I'm being deliberately extreme for the sake of the conversation as the sort of quote-unquote solution to everything.
Yeah.
So actually, don't worry about the workforce issues because there's an app for that. I'm being very glib.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you see where I'm going,
right?
Yeah.
It has a massive role to play. I mean, especially as we move from what Wes Streeting, the former health secretary, said was moving towards prevention over cure. His ethos was very much moving care into the community, getting people much more aware of their own state of their own health.
Yep.
and of course, preventing people from needing hospital care in the first place, moving it out of hospitals and into these regional clinics within town centres. Technology now, I mean, people have so much more access to their own health. You can, on your smartwatch, you can see, check your blood pressure. Mm-hmm. I was told by somebody at Apple recently, the latest version of the AirPods are going to be able to monitor your heart rate.
Cool.
As well.
What, from your ears?
From your ears, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
So there are huge advances, and there's an individual responsibility there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Because how many people, you have the NHS free... the midlife health checks now, where you can go and
NHS health check.
You can go and get your blood pressure done. But how many people actually take advantage of that?
So I do know the answer to that, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually do know.
Yeah.
So there are two programs which you're probably kind of referring to. One is very snappily titled the NHS England National Hypertension Case Finding Service.
Right.
Rolls off the tongue. And that's actually the ability that you have to go into a pharmacy and get your blood pressure checked.
Okay.
In any pharmacy. It's been a hugely successful national program. So massive credit to NHS England for doing this and all of the people in hypertension and CVD prevention and community pharmacy that delivered this. In the last year on record, they delivered 4 million blood pressure checks in England.
Yeah.
So that's the scale of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's just BP. And then the NHS health check, which is more of where PocDoc comes in and our technology can help deliver the health check, is your includes your lipid markers, your overall risk score, your BMI, and so on. That's about at 1 million to 1.5 per year.
Okay.
So, but out of an eligible population of more like 20 million, 15 to 20 million.
Yeah, yeah.
So those services, whilst being really well-meaning, are really just scratching the surface.
Yeah, but they're fairly new, reasonably new.
Hypertension's been around for about 4 or 5 years.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So, and then NHS Health Check's been around for a lot longer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
is quite surprising in a way that they aren't, that therefore more people don't take advantage of that. And I think perhaps this is what we'll come on to, perhaps talking about privatisation issues and things like that. You know, is there an assumption that people, if they find out there's something wrong with them, it's going to have some kind of cost, or they're going to have lifestyle changes, or it's not just about finding out what's wrong with you, it's about making those changes. I mean, people generally know if they're in good shape or not.
The way I think about these things is that there's no kind of silver bullet around, like, it's definitely like this or it's definitely like that. It's just 70 million people in the UK, really wide range of backgrounds, ethnicities, locations, communities, it's all different things. The one thing that we've seen consistently at PocDoc to be true is that there are definitely some people that don't care about their health. Like, that's definitely true. But it's not as big as you think. So one of the things when we started PocDoc, we were told was like, people will either get their health checked or they won't. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't influence the numbers.
Yeah.
They either care or they don't care. And I didn't believe that to be true. I thought it was more around making sure that you could reach the right people at the right time in the right way. And that's proven to be true. So it actually looks like it's more around finding the right way to reach people in a really busy society. Everyone's under lots of economic pressures, for example. Like, a really good use case is the NHS health check is from 40 to 74.
Yeah.
Okay. So really the majority of that age range up to 65 is when people are working.
Yeah.
Right. So 40 to 65 people are generally in full-time work. Mm-hmm. Of some kind, or, you know, some element of that's your work career before you retire. So, but the kind of age range on the health check skews massively older.
Mm-hmm.
So actually it's really around the fact that when the health check, in order to get your health check, you have to be able to available to go for 2 in-person appointments, if not 3 in-person appointments during work hours. That's going to be a massive blocker on uptake.
Just
like straight out the gate. So I think that there's more to it than just kind of, than being simple. I mean, one thing that we saw at PocDoc, for example, is we worked with a primary care network, which is like a collection of GP surgeries, about 50,000 patients. And we said, look, why don't you send a single SMS to your serial non-responders? So the people that hadn't responded to the letters inviting them to the health check for the last 5 or 6 years. So, and the primary care network in question was like, this won't work. They're not going to do it. We never hear from these people. They don't respond. So he sent them one SMS saying, you can come in. We're inviting you again to come in for your health check, or you can click this link and have a healthy heart check sent to you at home, and you can do it at home.
Right.
We got 80% uptake off of a single SMS.
Right.
And so our conclusion from that and other things was, actually, if it's the right intervention in the right way,
you'll see.
There's a reason, for example, why there's 4 times as many blood pressure checks being done than the NHS health check is because you can go into any pharmacy on the high street and you can walk in and it takes 15 minutes and it's a single appointment. Like, that seems a pretty clear data point to me.
So before
we get into the next step, I have to stop for a commercial break. So we are going to be right back with the next part of today's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Paul Gallagher, who is one of the UK's leading writers and journalists in the area of health. We will be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of today's episode of the Health Tech Hour with my guest, Paul Gallagher. So, Paul, where do you stand as a writer, having looked at the kind of arc of the development of the healthcare system around this issue of privatization? So privatization of the NHS comes up in every election, every single election.
Every week in every newsroom.
Every single time any politician talks about the NHS, it seems to be a thing that they say that they're against.
Absolutely.
What are they against? What do you think they're against? What are they trying to communicate, or what are people worried about?
I think it's an idea that's got into the nation's head that privatization equals sell off.
Yep.
The NHS is very much our sacred cow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 75 years old now, 76 years old now. This idea of universal free healthcare, free at the point of use, and anybody who comes along and suggests so much as restructuring that or selling off little bits of that, you know, should be hung, drawn and quartered. But I think what people don't know is that lots of parts of the NHS are privatised already. Lots of trusts outsource blood services or other areas of the healthcare. I think last time I checked, it was roughly 7 or 8% of all NHS health services are run by private companies.
Right.
Something like that. Maybe close to 10% now. But there's just been this wave of fear that anybody so much as suggests NHS reform, and it's particularly aimed at the Conservatives.
Okay.
The Conservatives seem to be the ones. It's a common attack from the Labour Party that the Conservatives just simply want to sell it off, privatise the NHS to their rich friends. It's just been one of those political attacks that have been going on for years. I think people are afraid that if you introduce any kind of private healthcare reform, they will start having to pay for things, pay for a GP appointment or make some kind of contribution.
Right.
But of course, everybody, unless you are, unless there are reasons not to, everybody makes a contribution towards their medicine with the pharmacy charge.
Yep.
Is it £9.90 now or something like that? So when they go to see their NHS dentist, you have to pay towards that, depending on what level of care you're having with the dentist. I mean, I just took my wife and two children to the dentist the other day, and it was just a checkup, and it was something like best part of £100 for the four of us. So there is an element of being used to paying for healthcare here, but for whatever reason, there is an assumption that the Tories in particular are going to sell off the entire NHS and that standards are going to fall, standards are going to plummet, and there'll be no more free universal healthcare. And that's just a fear that's ingrained with millions of people around the country, I think.
So you think the fear is fundamentally that it stops being free at the point of use?
Yeah, absolutely.
And therefore, if you're not paying for it, then you won't get it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Jeremy Hunt, when he was health secretary in the mid-2010s, suggested that something like one in three people who turn up at A&E don't need to be at A&E. Mm-hmm. There are huge numbers of people who don't turn up for their GP appointment.
Yep.
And that has a cost, and this all adds up. And the NHS isn't awash with money, despite the fact that its budget is absolutely enormous.
£130 billion.
Yeah, I think it's something now, I think it's 40% of all public spending is the Department of Health.
Right.
It's just enormous. So it goes back to what we were discussing earlier. Why does it have so many of these problems? But it's nobody has worked out how you stop that, how you prevent people not turning up for their appointments under the current system, or how you stop people going to A&E. So I think Hunt floated the idea that, well, why don't we start charging people for that, and immediately he was shouted down as being this Tory who wanted to privatise the NHS.
I remember that, and I'm no fan of. I think universal healthcare for all is amazing. The thing that I dislike is the inability to have the people that we elect to have difficult discussions about things are hamstrung from having those difficult discussions because there are things that you're not even allowed to sort of talk about or debate.
Yeah.
That concerns me in any sector, not just health.
Yeah. But it's surprising because the problems across the NHS are enormous. I mean, I don't know when the last time you tried to get a GP appointment is, but certainly when I've tried for myself and my family, you're lucky to get one within 10 days.
Right.
Everybody knows how important continuity of care is and seeing the same GP, but I can't remember the last time I saw the same GP or anybody I know saw the same GP two appointments in a row, spread apart for two different things. You see somebody different every time you see the GP. You wait months and months to get referred to a specialist if you need to. These are huge problems, the structural problems that aren't going away. I mean, I wrote about the NHS winter crisis every single winter for 10 years. We'd write about the NHS winter crisis.
Yep.
And it's all short-termism. So lo and behold, whoever was health secretary at the time would inject X hundreds of millions of pounds extra over the winter just to see us through the winter. But then you'd be back to square one sort of the following autumn, depending on how bad the flu season was, for example. And you're just going around in circles as well with the level of care within the NHS. And now you've got to add to the fact that we've got this enormous backlog of people waiting. And we know that the longer somebody has to wait for their operation, the more likely it is they're going to get sicker and need a more serious operation, which is going to cost more. But nobody's really talking about a fundamental reform of the system. I mean, there are lots of different healthcare systems across the world.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I was going to say. So, who are we aiming to be? Who are we comparing ourselves to?
So, I mean, we just want to compare ourselves to countries that have the best outcomes, I think.
Okay.
I don't think now, even if you had to start a new healthcare system from scratch, I'm not sure how many people would set up an NHS style system looking at the problems that we have. I imagine they'd set up some much more of a European-based system where everybody has a level of social health insurance. I've got a relative in Belgium who's lived in Belgium now for more years than they have in England, and they're a huge fan of that kind of system.
Why are they a fan of it?
Because the level of healthcare coverage, the lack of delays when they want to see the local doctor, or if somebody needs an operation, there isn't that level of backlog.
And why is it a much smaller population than a country like Belgium. I think this is a really interesting, and I think this is one of the things that concerns me about the lack of ability to debate these different models in public.
Yeah.
For the elected leaders to debate them with some safety about not being pilloried in the press, about being anti-NHS and things like that, because it stifles things. So what is it about a social insurance model that helps reduce backlog? It's a genuine question. I don't actually know the answer.
No, I mean, from talking to Mark, by the sounds of it, it just seems a better funding model.
Okay.
So it just seems to be
a cleaner reimbursement model.
The funds are spread much more evenly. There's no postcode lottery like we have here. Mm. I mean, I think people assume that with the NHS, it's universal healthcare. It's the same level of healthcare all across the country. And that's completely not the case. I mean,
even before you get into Scotland and Wales.
Yeah. I mean, just in England alone, you're twice as likely to die of a stroke in the rural parts of the country than you are in the city, just because of the length of time it will take somebody to get to you by an ambulance. I mean, you mentioned about the rest of the UK. I mean, a few years ago, I had an uncle in Belfast, a family in Belfast, who in the winter popped out at half-time for a football match, slipped on the snow, compound fracture of his leg, and the ambulance said, could you please get somebody to take you into the hospital because we don't have any available. This is Belfast.
Wow.
City of 1.2 or over a million people. It's disgusting. It's disgraceful. I don't know why people aren't more open to discussing. Well, it's partly because if you were going to change something, I had a conversation recently with a very senior member within the NHS, and I floated this idea. It's off the record, so
of course
you can't say who it was.
No, don't say who it was.
And I asked this idea, why don't we have this, even look at, have a royal commission where you would look at changing the entire system from the current system to, say, European-style system, or part private, part public system. And their argument was, well, we could do that. We'd spend 3 years looking at all this and spend X hundreds of millions of pounds on it and end up with the same system because the politicians aren't strong enough to drive through that level of reform.
Yeah, it's super tricky, right? Because in some ways, in many ways, the NHS does an incredible job.
And
I don't think there's anyone in the UK, that would choose the US system.
No, but that's one of the problems. Everybody brings the US system up and says, if you go into question time or something like that and NHS reform comes up, you'll immediately get a handful of people in the audience saying, we don't want to become the US. But nobody's has ever suggested moving to a US-style system. Well, I spent a couple of years in Japan. I used to live in Japan. They have a different system themselves where pretty much everybody spends whatever procedure you have, if it's just a general appointment with a GP or a major cancer surgery, you contribute roughly 30% to everything. And that country, we mentioned Belgium, is much smaller than the UK. Japan is twice the size in population terms of the UK.
Okay.
And their healthcare outcomes are much stronger than ours.
And what about people on low income?
Yeah, there is an insurance model a basic level of healthcare. But by and large, everybody in Japan makes a certain amount of contribution to their healthcare. And again, you walk into Japan and if you see the hospitals there, they're generally in a lot better condition than ours. I mean, we can talk about some of the state of the hospitals, which we've covered, the capital backlog, the capital spend, the amount of money that the NHS needs to improve the level of hospitals is something like, it's gone up, goes up every year. It's about £15 billion that the NHS now needs, which is what, 12 to 15% of its budget, just to repair the hospitals to the standard they should be. Everyone's scrambling around for cash, for staff.
Because it seems, it does, when you portray it like that, it does seem somewhat insurmountable. So how do we make it
surmountable? Of course, Andy Burnham's coming in now, and the first line of attack against him is that he's to the left of the Labour Party, he's going to raise taxes. And you think, a lot of people, if it was spent wisely, the tax, very few people would say, look, this is the level of, we're something like 15th or 16th of OECD countries in terms of cancer outcomes.
Okay.
Which is pretty poor, given we're the sixth richest country in the world. if you could say, look, I'm going to raise taxes by this amount and spend it on building X number of hospitals, improving our level of cancer care, hiring 20,000 more surgeons, midwives, he perhaps would get a lot of support for that. But it's just it's one of those frequent attack lines where, why is he going to raise our taxes? He's going to take our money? And in the current climate where everything has become much more expensive, the cost of the living crisis that we live in, it's an impossible job.
What can they actually, as a slight aside, are they actually able to ring fence tax like that? Well,
National Insurance is effectively a ring fence tax for health.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Norman Baker, when he was a health minister, advocated a hypothecated tax outside of that, so raising the level of tax by 1% and saying that's just for the NHS and the Department of Health. But again, 40p in every pound of taxpayers' money is currently spent towards the Department of Health and NHS England. So it's, you could keep on raising taxes.
To your point earlier, though, about the British people wanting subconsciously a kind of Scandinavian quality, but pay US tax for
tax,
it.
Yeah.
What's the difference between tax rates in the UK and Scandinavian countries? Like, what's the difference we're talking about?
Oh, I think if you're on sort of our lower bracket of 20-25%. I think it's equivalent. I mean, people in Scandinavian countries would pay well above 40-45%.
Oh, wow.
If you're on an average income.
So it's significantly higher.
Significantly higher. Yeah, it is.
Wow.
But they have significantly better public health services. I mean, you look at sort of these annual surveys that are done about who are the happiest people on earth. It's inevitably the Norwegians or the Swedes or the Finns always tend to come up on top. And because health is so interconnected to everything, health and well-being, mental and physical health, and there's no great surprise that they are.
And what role does the media have in driving this debate, or the honesty around this debate, or sort of, because the media can be can often be driving the short-termism.
Yep, absolutely.
Particularly at a political level.
Absolutely, yeah. It's kind of that circle where the politicians are responding to the 24/7 news agenda, and the media is simply putting newspapers out, broadcasts out every day, so they're responding to what the politicians are saying. So there's a lack of long-termism in the media as well. And of course, bad news is good news for the media. You only have to look at what's gone on with the latest maternity scandal in Nottingham. I mean, I started as health correspondent writing about the fallout of what was going on in Morecambe Bay and the maternity scandal there. And then we had East Kent and the maternity scandal there. And then we had that moved on to Shropshire. And now we've got Nottingham. There's a lack of learning within the NHS itself. I mean, that report, it was heartbreaking to read. It was scandalous. No one's named. So is there a level of accountability that we're missing here? No one's named in that report.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Were they named in the other reports?
I don't recall anybody, certainly not off the top of my head, whether there was any of the senior managers that were directly responsible for the poor care were named. But that's generally been the case with NHS reports. It takes a long time. Inevitably, you read one of these reports and there'll be a new chief exec will have come in by the time that they realise they're under investigation, because, of course, these investigations can take quite a long time to complete. And the standard response is, we've moved on, lessons have been learned. But they clearly haven't at the national level. Because why have we had four major maternity scandals in the last 12, 13 years if lessons are being learned? But they're not.
Yeah, I don't have a solution to that.
Yeah. It's the NHS, one of the problems is it's terrible about opening up when there is a major scandal, and add mid staffs to that.
And you're saying that from your perspective as a journalist, when you've been covering these stories, trying to get them to open up has been difficult.
Well, most of these stories, a lot of these stories have come about because of journalists finding out there's been really, really poor healthcare, especially with Nottingham.
Okay.
A lot of the great work was done by the Sunday Times in terms of highlighting the problems. And it's often a last resort. These families are going through complete heartbreak. And they want an internal report to be carried out into the death of their baby.
Right.
But it doesn't happen. So they often go to the press as a last resort. And so the press writes the stories about these issues. And then somebody, a politician, says, this is negative.
The local MP, for example.
Local MP. raise it with the health secretary. If the health secretary looks at it and says it's bad enough for a serious investigation, independent investigation like the ones we've seen recently that I named just there, that will happen. But people just want, whenever there's big scandal, they want those lessons to be learned, not just within the regional trust, they want them to be learned nationwide. And I think that's part of the problem, that especially maternity, which there's this national review going on that West Streeting commissioned a few months ago, which is yet to report back. And it is difficult to see why these lessons aren't being learned and why there's overall level of care, not just with maternity, but with social care that we've mentioned already, these improvements that people want to see aren't coming through.
Yeah, I don't know why not. I mean, I think it's one of the, and it's not just in maternity. I think it's one of the big questions about how can the NHS continue to improve.
Yeah. And it basically comes back to funding, which is what we started talking about, you know, whether or not this funding model that it has at the minute, is that enough, that it just comes through general taxation, or is there a new model that we need?
Because you know what's interesting, and again, I'm not an expert on those cases, those really tragic cases, so I guess I'm talking more generally, and this is an impression that I had, so it's highly subjective, so consider what I'm about to say heavily caveated. There doesn't seem to be, in those reports and the reporting and the statements about those incidents, a real open admission, which is like, we just don't have the right resource levels. We just don't have, we used to have this many staff, and we just don't have that staff. It always seems to be about the training, or the, we should have done this and we should have done that, which could also be true. But if you had more staff, more better staff, I don't know, it almost seems to be like the resource issue, which is a money issue and a training issue, just seems to be a bit like a bit of a white elephant here, or a bit of a kind of no-go zone.
I think generally when you dig into the reports, it's generally a combination of the two. It's the lack of resources, but then it's also the personnel issues. For example, in the Nottingham case, there was one particular part of that report which stood out, which was whenever there was a particular difficult pregnancy, a lot of the senior midwives would think it was a bit of a laugh to put the really newly qualified midwives in charge of that lady's healthcare. Yeah. I mean, these are extraordinary cases that came up time and time again within the Ockenden.
That's cultural.
Yeah, exactly. Because it went on for that length of time. It's a cultural issue. But there is a shortage of midwives, roughly 2,000 short.
Yeah.
40,000 nurses short across England.
That's going to have an impact.
And it was only towards the end of Rishi Sunak's time that his government put together a long-term workforce plan, which looked at the next 5-10 years, how many extra doctors, nurses.
That's how long you have to think.
Yeah, and it didn't go. It hadn't happened for so long. He put it in place, but that's what, 3 or 4 years now. So, like with anything within healthcare and the NHS, it's going to take time to kick in.
Yeah. So we have to go for our final commercial break. And then after we come back, I want to talk about your work with the Alzheimer's in the Alzheimer's area. So I think it's gaining ever more traction in the media, quite rightly, along with its sort of, I guess, sister MND. You know, there's getting more and more high profile cases, more and more investment into to drugs and to treatment, more and more highlighting of what we don't know. So we will be right back with the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Paul Gallagher, who is one of the leading healthcare writers in the UK.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Paul Gallagher, who's one of the UK's leading writers around health and healthcare. So what was your journey like into the area of Alzheimer's? Because I know that you're deep into, well, very close to publishing a really exciting seminal document, report.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. So I've been a health correspondent at the iPaper for 10 years. And then, like all newspapers, around the country have been feeling the squeeze in recent years with sales and income. And so there were a level of redundancies that were made last year. And I was one of a number of senior staff that decided to leave the Eye. And fortuitously, I was offered this role with Alzheimer's Disease International just towards the end of my time at the Eye. To write their annual report for Alzheimer's Disease International. They produce one every year, usually internally, but occasionally in the past they've got a health journalist on board. And so I've been spending the last 6-7 months talking to scientists, researchers, clinical trials participants all over the world, because the focus of this year's report is on clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. And it's been a fascinating process, because I think the longest article I ever wrote in the newspaper was something like 2,500-3,000 words, whereas this is going to be 130,000 words, but 150-page report. And like with any area of international healthcare, there's imbalances. But with Alzheimer's in particular, I mean, the one interview I did which really stuck in the mind recently was one scientist based here in the UK, but also works in the US, called it a pandemic.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because of the level of, not only the level of unmet need for patients who are already been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but also the number of people who will inevitably get a diagnosis in the coming years.
What's the incident rate? What do we think it's currently tracking at?
So it's over 1 million people have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's in the UK. And globally, it's something like 50 million, or it's projected to be 50 million towards the end of this decade.
Wow.
And it's only going to go up because, of course,
we're aging.
We're an aging world, and countries across Africa and South Asia are aging at a faster rate now than us. And so the incidence over there is going to be a lot higher in the coming years. And what I found specifically is that there are only sort of a handful of areas in the world where those clinical trials are taking place.
Mm.
And that itself is quite a big issue, because Alzheimer's disease is incredibly complex. I mean, there's still no consensus exactly what causes Alzheimer's disease.
Is that right?
There are issues with two main proteins that are believed to be largely responsible, amyloid beta and tau. But whether they're solely responsible or they are a cause of the disease and not a symptom is still an ongoing debate.
Really?
And there was a big breakthrough a couple of years ago when we had these new drugs that came onto the market, lecanemab and donanemab, a big conference in San Francisco which announced this. They were the first ever disease-modifying therapies for Alzheimer's disease. So the first ever drugs which were proven to slow down the progress of the disease. And so you'd been looking at sort of 30 years of failures, although scientists don't like to call it failures, because every time you have a clinical trial which doesn't perhaps prove its hypothesis, you learn something.
You do, yeah.
But these drugs were shown to have an effect, but only if you got those drugs to the patients quick enough and early enough into their Alzheimer's journey.
Okay. How early? Roughly.
Mild cognitive impairment.
Oh, really? Really
at
early?
The maximum. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And so one of the central issues, of course, is the delays in getting a diagnosis, because it's still seen, even in countries like the UK, as a natural part of aging, even amongst the medical community. That's one of the biggest frustrations that the scientists and researchers have that I've spoken to, is that you just have this level of not only a stigma, because it's very, very difficult for somebody to come out and admit once they've got a diagnosis that they have it, because people are worried about the reaction that others have. We saw that in Jon Snow, who was recently diagnosed, who recently announced his diagnosis, but he'd had it for a few years prior. But there's a problem with actually getting treatments in the first place. So people either not being diagnosed, or they're being diagnosed too late for any of these treatments to have an effect. And of course, with those two drugs in particular, they got a license in the UK, but because of their expense and because there was an issue with side effects, they were not given the green light for use on the NHS.
That was it lecanemab?
Lecanemab and donanemab.
Lecanemab, yeah, I think, hit the news. There was a big, there was a big hoo-ha about that one, because it got regulatory approval.
That's right.
But it wasn't accepted by NICE.
That's right, the NHS spending watchdog.
To be reimbursed under the NHS.
That's right, yeah.
But other countries did.
Yeah.
Which created this, it was a very tense media moment.
Yeah.
For the healthcare system.
That's right, yeah. That was quite controversial. because it has a minimal effect, I think something like a year's treatment is £20,000-£30,000.
Okay.
And because it's so difficult to get a diagnosis, to get an Alzheimer's diagnosis here in the UK, you need to have a PET scan or a lumbar puncture.
Oh, wow.
Although now we're seeing the dawn of blood-based biomarkers, which hopefully will improve.
Kind of the liquid easier. Biopsy type
exactly.
thing.
Yeah, it'll make it easier for people to get diagnosis. But at the minute, that's kind of the gold standard of getting a diagnosis.
And I bet it's not quick to end up in a PET scan.
No, exactly.
There's probably quite a few steps you have to go through.
Yeah, very much so. So there are all these kind of issues which we try to bring in to ADI's report this year. And ultimately, we want to come up with a number of recommendations to improve those clinical trials, not just in the UK, but worldwide as well.
And what are you said before the show, without wishing to kind of give too much away, there's some really exciting things and there's still some really challenging things in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's just a conference, Alzheimer's Association International Conference, going on in London as we speak right now, as we've got the world's sort of leading experts here discussing that, hopefully making some announcements today and tomorrow about new drugs that are about to come on the scene. I think because we've seen in oncology, once there is that initial breakthrough of cancer treatments, that you kind of see a snowball effect. And that's what a lot of people are expecting and hoping to see with Alzheimer's over the next few years. Ultimately, from my conversations, the thinking is that the treatments, you're not just going to have a single treatment for Alzheimer's. You're probably going to have something that's targeting more than one issue within the brain.
Right.
It'll be a combination of treatments, personalised medicine, because Alzheimer's affects different people depending on their backgrounds, sex, ethnicity as well.
And do they know why those differences occur, or they've just observed that there are differences?
They've observed, so it could partly be the genetic makeup, because if some people have got two copies of this gene, the APOE4 gene, they're much more likely, in fact pretty much guaranteed, to get Alzheimer's at some point during their lifetime. Some people just have one copy, some people won't have any of copy, so it's a genetic makeup as well. But anything involving the brain, hugely complex, and so there's all this research going on around the world. It's a fascinating time, and lots of great research going on. And it's only going to become more important with the number of people who are going to develop Alzheimer's in the coming years.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, it sounds like to me, it's going to be one of the really hot areas to solve for. And so it sounds like you get a lot of personal value from being involved in that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a real challenge. As I say, it's on a scale of writing that I've never done before. It's quite a difference to what I've been used to, but it's been fascinating to really get into that level of detail with such an important issue. Because you rarely meet somebody who hasn't been affected by Alzheimer's, a relative or a friend who's had it. And then once you talk to them about it, there's a huge amount of frustration that the level of support, treatment, or the delays it took to get them a diagnosis, or they might not have been given any kind of post-diagnostic care as well. And there's a sense of, for so long, there's been a sense of hopelessness. It's been a case of, that's the one disease that nobody wants to get because of a lack of treatment and a lack of care, a lack of awareness. But that, thankfully, is starting to change slowly but surely. And hopefully, now that we've had this initial breakthrough, there'll be a lot more investment, a lot more pharmaceutical companies putting a lot more effort into producing new treatments. Now that we know we can make a difference, hopefully we'll start to see that in the years ahead.
Great. Well, look, Paul, that's the end of the show. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you very much to everyone listening. And we will be back again next week with another show. Thank you.